104.5 The Zone. Hitting the links with you on a Saturday morning. This is Talking Golf with Virgil Herring on 104.5 The Zone.
Good morning. Time to talk a little golf. And you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Got a great show lined up for us today. When we go to the range, we'll be dealing with Michael Finney. He's going to step us through some of the most technical parts of the game when it comes to the golf swing and see if we can't simplify it down to make your game better today. Jim Nugent's going to join us when he always does at the 15 to write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning. But joining me now is the author of Pro Golf Synopsis, probably one of the finest ebooks out there when it comes to understanding the analytics of the game, Rich Hunt. Rich, how are today, buddy?
Good. How you doing this morning, Virgil?
Fantastic. Well, we got the Players' Championship coming up, and the Players' Championship is such a unique event because it has a unique blend of putting out big names as winners, minus Craig Perks, but it doesn't seem to always bring the hottest player to the victory stand outside of maybe Tiger once and Duval once. What makes the Players' Championship such a unique championship when it comes to deciding who's going to win?
Well, the biggest thing that stands out is that out of the 10 par fours, every one of them is a dogleg, and they have five dogleg lefts and five dogleg rights. So that, and the course is fairly tight by tour standards. So what happens is you need a lot of it's a course that favors good drivers of the ball more than most courses on tour, but it's more about good drivers of the ball gaining strokes through accuracy and being able to angle their approach shots to give themselves the best angle into the green versus, you know, going out there and just overpowering the course. You're not going to be able to overpower Sawgrass.
I found it interesting. We were collectively involved in a discussion with Brandel Chambly about him, how he was talking about nobody drives the golf ball like Hogan anymore, and how Faldo went to, you know, Hogan to talk about the importance of driving the golf ball in a certain area. And he said that part of the game is lost. And you made that point about the Players' Championship. And it's interesting, the golf courses that demand old school precision, the big names no longer play. And I find that interesting, but yet not so much, because as a person who hits the ball very long, those golf courses feel like they take my most important weapon away. But what's your take on his stance that, you know, the lost art of driving the golf ball is plaguing the game?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see his perspective on that. You know, it's just that if you look at every year and you look at the Tour Championship, where you could say that basically the top 30 players on tour have made the Tour Championship, their club speed numbers, ball speed numbers, everything that has to do with power is significantly higher than the average tour player. So obviously power is a big thing. And as a result of that as well, what courses have done is that they've been designed to allow for more power and a little more errant shots. So you don't have to be as precise. And I think also the golf ball has a little bit to do with that. You're not playing back in the days of Bellotta golf balls where the ball would curve a little bit more. So it was probably a little bit easier to curve the ball to get a better angle on the green. Now it's just it's a straighter golf ball, so guys can just hit it as far as they can and hit it straight. So I think all that stuff is a big factor into what Brandel's been saying.
Well, that's interesting that you opened up that can of worms for me. That was very kind of you. When it comes to the game and this constant talk of the ball being the problem and the I'm not sure how much of it's the ball, how much of it's the driver being 440 cc's and sure. The sweet spot's now bigger than my old tour preferred head when I was a high school kid. And what's your feeling on where the tour might go? And do you have any like stats to back up the fact that maybe we need to roll it back one way or the other?
Well, I think the tour, what they're going to probably do is try to do something with a golf ball. Personally, myself, I'm against that. I just think that, I mean, we know what the golf ball can do. What we've seen in recent years is a lot of changes in the center of gravity of the center of gravity location in the head. And, there was a video on YouTube, it was just shot not too long ago, where they had a guy hit with the same golf ball, he hit the TaylorMade R7, which was back in 2007, and then he hit the M1, and same guy, same type of contact and everything, and he hit the M1 like 20 yards further. So I think there's a lot more to do with, athletes, golfers today, swing mechanics, more guys are hitting more up on the ball, to hit the ball further, and as well as kind of what the driver head technology is kind of in a way that's being designed now. I think those are bigger factors in the golf ball at this point.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not so sure that I'm all in on the golf ball being the problem. Although I'd like to see it spin a little bit more. That might do a better job of differentiating who's better or not.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, I actually think it's a combination of athlete, driver head technology, and the fact that we got guys who worked for NASA for 25 years, they retire and they get picked up by the big companies. My understanding is from the people that I deal with at Callaway is that whatever they decide to do will take about a year, and the people behind the ball will make it work no matter what. So it doesn't make much of a difference. As we go to your amazing work with Pro Golf Synopsis and all the things that you provide us with that, who do you see being the favorites going into the Players' Championship?
Well, we talked about this earlier, how the Players is kind of if you look at it, the top names are still very able to come away and win at Sawgrass, but you see a lot of lesser-known names kind of in contention there more than usual, and it usually leads to fans being a little bit disappointed sometimes, but a guy I like Henrik Stenson quite a bit there. That's the type of course that could fit him really well. Justin Rose and Justin Thomas are other big names up there. As far as kind of more dark horse picks, I like Brian Harman quite a bit, and I like Byung-Hun An. He goes by Ben An. He's a former Korean player. He's really striking the ball extremely well right now, and he's not too far away from getting a victory pretty soon. And also, I like Rafa Cabrera-Bello as well. He's kind of a dark horse guy.
Interesting. And as you look at it, every listener out there is intrigued by the new and improved Tiger Woods version. And sometimes his numbers off the tee don't necessarily add up. Like this week, it appears that he's driving the golf ball better and putting it worse. What's your take on the possibilities of Tiger Woods coming out on top at the Players' Championship?
Well, he could do it. I know Sawgrass, he said in the past that it's not his really favorite course as far as fitting his eye. The good thing about there is, as we talked about earlier, how it's really more about precision, and he can get away more with hitting two irons off the tee. I think that the issue for him is that if he can get over this mental jag with his driver, that would probably be the biggest difference in the world. As far as his putting at Quail Hollow, I mean, it's probably not very advisable to use putting as a predictor for winners. It's just because putting comes and goes with everybody. And Quail Hollow is kind of a course that just Tiger Woods has just not putted very well in the past. So, I mean, I think he's got a decent chance, but I'm still have some questions about his driving.
So do I. I think that's the last piece that's going to take him to wherever he wants to go, and what it, we would consider his maybe his 6.0 version of himself. But it's definitely. I'm surprised that he cleaned up his short game after what we saw the last couple of years. He did it so quickly, so that just tells you how much pain he was in. But the driver has been elusive for quite some time, so that's going to be the big piece to his success, especially in major championships, because he can't get away with driving it as crazy wild as he does. So, we've been listening to Rich Hunt. He's the author of Pro Golf Synopsis, really one of the finest reads if you love to understand how to gain strokes, where the strokes are gained, and how to become a better player with analytics. Rich, how can my listeners get in touch with your great information?
You can just go to my website, which is at 3Jack, which is spelled with the number 3, and then jack.blogspot.com.
You're the man, brother. Have a great round of golf today, and I look forward to catching up with you really soon, okay?
All right. Thank you very much, Virgil.
My pleasure. When we come back, we're going to write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning, so stick around. You are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone.
Tony Barnhart talks college football with you every Saturday, presented by Stroud's Barbecue and by Tennessee Steel Haulers. Saturday mornings at 9:15 on 104.5 The Zone.
You are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. If you'd like to get involved with the show, hit me up on Twitter. I am at Virgil Torspin. It's at this time every Saturday morning. We bring in the founder of Global Golf Post to write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning, Jim Nugent. Nuge, how are you today, buddy?
Doing well, Virgil. Thank you for having me on today.
My pleasure. I was looking at the leaderboard, and I saw that Tiger and Phil and Rory are all lumped together, tied, and then I realized that I was reading the leaderboard upside down as they barely made the cut. Very intriguing is the Wells Fargo event. Great golf course, and it's got them a little tricked up this week with the greens not so fast, but really firm. And obviously, I don't think any of those three that we discussed are going to win this week, but we got a host of intriguing names at the top with Peter Malnati leading by one over Jason Day and a really great young player, Aaron Wise. What's your take so far through two rounds at the Wells Fargo?
A little surprised. It does appear to be a somewhat different golf course than we saw last August when Justin Thomas won the PGA Championship there. Certainly it is a different time of year, so I get that. But the players, all of them, and no one more so probably than Tiger Woods, are really struggling with the speed of the greens. Somewhat surprising to see that some of the other brand names, Ricky Fowler, Phil Mickelson, and Justin Thomas himself, really don't appear to be a factor this week either.
And it's so interesting how a golf course can play that different. And obviously, it's the beginning of May, and that's in August, and that allows the rough to be a lot thicker and the Bermuda grass to be in a better situation to play on. But it generally is an amazing test, especially the last three holes are such a beast. And I'm just wondering, is it Jason Day's turn to get back into the fray? And he's kind of fallen off in the debate on who's the best player, but 2 years ago, we were thinking this guy is the best player in the world. Is it Jason Day's time to return?
You know, I kind of think so. He looks good. He looks healthy. He's hitting the ball a long way. He's got a bounce in his step, kind of similar to what we see when Roy McIlroy is playing well. It's nice to see him return because he really, after Whistling Straits, disappeared for all intents and purposes. Last year he just wasn't a factor at all. It's good to see him try and reenter the conversation about who are the elite players on the tour at this point in time.
Yeah, no question about it. There are two young names that have me intrigued, and one of them is about ready to earn his PGA Tour card without having to go through Q School, which is quite an achievement. Sam Burns is tied for 7th, 3 under par. superstar player and been so in the junior ranks, college ranks, and now professional. Tell us a little bit about Sam Burns and why should we be so excited about where he's going.
You're going to be talking about Sam Burns on this radio show for a long time. This kid is the real deal. LSU educated, turned pro early, has a chip on his shoulder. Kind of an interesting backstory. Arguably the one of the very best players in the college game last year, but he didn't get selected by the United States Golf Association to play on the Walker Cup team, which came as a quite a surprise to many people who are following the amateur game. And you don't have to even ask him, and he'll talk about it. He's still irritated. He's going to be irritated. He's going to use it as motivation for a very long time. This kid's got all the tools. And as I said, you're going to be talking about him a lot. Your listeners are going to get used to hearing this name. He's kind of the next big thing in on the PGA Tour, in my estimation.
Yeah, I agree. And thinking of the next big thing, 15 years ago, Charles Howe III was that guy. And at some point, he's got a bankload of money, but he's only got a couple of wins underneath him. But he's really starting to come back around again. It'd be nice to see Charles Howe III, who's really such a class act kid. Not that he's a kid anymore, but just such an awesome guy. And I'd love to see him get back in winner's circle. What is your take on Charlie Triple Sticks getting his first victory in a long time?
Well, you're right. You know, 15 years ago, he was the next big thing. There was a time at the U.S. Amateur when Tiger was trying to win his third and final U.S. Amateur at Pumpkin Ridge that a young kid named Charlie Howell with three sticks after his name had Tiger down on the backside of their match and almost won. It didn't happen that way. And unfortunately for Charlie, his career hasn't worked out the way most people thought that it would. We all thought he was, as you said, the next big thing, but he is a human ATM machine. He puts his card in the machine at the beginning of the year. And at the end of the year, he always seems to take $2 million out, rarely contends, rarely wins, but makes cuts all the time and makes a ton of money. And he's become an outstanding citizen on that tour. Boy, if he could putt, it's amazing to think what his career could have been like.
Yeah, no question. Rory McIlroy, who I have said 1,000 times on this show is my favorite player to watch and to cover, recently just keeps on saying things that either you love him or you hate him for, because he's willing to offer you insight that the previous generation wouldn't offer. But he was quick to put down the USGA and the US Open and the British Open or the Open Championship and declare that the Masters is a cut above all the other majors in every way. Very interesting stance. I don't know what led that to that kind of a statement, but what's your take on Rory McIlroy and his much more openness to be a little provocative?
I don't know where that came from. I was surprised at the firmness of the statement, if you will, just how adamant he was. He tried to walk it back a little bit yesterday. I don't think he was very successful in doing that. You know, we just talked about a guy who looked like he was going to be the next big thing in Charlie Hull. Roy McIlroy is creeping up on 30 years old. Granted, he's one tournament away from the career Grand Slam, but I don't think that his career is working out quite the way that we all thought it was going to. He's not a dominant player out there. He's not necessarily a guy who you can count on to contend and win every time he shows up. He's not the Roy McIlroy that we thought he was going to be 3 or 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what happens to people who can't putt. And you know, it's just one of those things where he has the firepower to run away like only Tiger Woods had in his prime, essentially. But for some reason, I think that he just wanted to perfect his putting and he'd lost the art of it and it totally ate his lunch. So I'm a little bit concerned about where he is with that part of his game, because you can't win major championships on the golf courses that they generally play and not be a better than average putter. I just don't see it.
you can't win on the PGA Tour if you can't putt. And there's tons of examples of guys who don't have half the game that Rory has, but they can putt, who are making a good living and winning out there. So you're exactly right. And, you know, that was the issue with Charlie Howell. He loved to hit balls. He loved to watch his ball flight. He just would pound balls all day long, and then he'd putt for 15 or 20 minutes before he got in his car and went home for the day. And I don't know if that's the case with Rory, but that 14th club in his bag is letting him down.
Yeah, I agree. Well, one of the reasons why I love having you on the show is because you know and you cover more than just the tours. College golf has had a very interesting ruling, and my listeners are plenty of them are parents of junior golfers and junior golfers themselves, and they've taken away the early visit much more so than they have in the past. Obviously, they've now taken it back to almost 2 years prior to, so you can't have any of these eighth grader early commits to Texas. How big of a deal is the NCAA stance on junior golfers visiting their schools early, and where did this come from?
I'm not sure exactly where it came from, and I'm not sure that it's really that big a deal. You know, the kids that are playing junior golf who are going to go to school are playing golf almost all year long, but certainly all during the summer. And the coaches are going to get out there and they're going to watch the kids. They're going to meet the parents. They're going to figure out from the rankings who's good and who's not. And just because you can't make so-called early visits doesn't mean that an eighth grader is not going to get a scholarship offer from Texas or Oklahoma State at a very young age. I think this is window dressing. I think they're trying to make it seem like they're cleaning up their act and trying to be a little bit more responsible. But I don't think it's going to change any behavior. The really good and talented kids are going to get recruited just as soon as they can prove at whatever age that they're big time. And nothing is going to change that. It's kind of like college basketball. You know, there's this alternative universe out there called AAU. And the NCAA can't do anything to stop or shut down AAU basketball. And the same thing's going on here.
Yeah, it seems like if there's an organization that needs to be completely revamped, it's the NCAA. Sometimes they do things that just makes me scratch my head, whether they come down with sanctions that don't match what they of a previous decision that they made, or they make up this big deal similar to this, and it's really nothing more than smoke and mirrors to deflect you looking away from the actual fact that there's 100 other ways for them to get eighth graders to sign to go to their school if they're so good. So just another wah-wah when it comes to the NCAA.
It's a vile and corrupt organization, and we don't have time to discuss that on the show. We'd need a full Saturday, all 12 hours of it, to get into the NCAA.
You got that right. Well, as you see it, how do you see the headlines reading on Monday morning for the Global Golf Post?
Going with my heart and my head on this one, the headline on our issue Monday says, "A New Day." I think you're going to see a new Jason Day or reinvigorated Jason Day. I think he wins at Wells Fargo, and I think it jumpstarts his year. I look for him to contend in the remaining majors in 2018.
Yeah, he'd be a solid pick for Shinnecock Hills, too, so I like that selection. How can my listeners get in touch or get a copy of the Global Golf Post?
You can get a free subscription to Global Golf Post at globalgolfpost.com. We're published every Monday morning at 6 a.m. Nashville time. We're a free publication, and we're going to tell you everything you need to know about what happened in the game of golf around the world last week, including how Jason Day wrestled a big golf course in North Carolina.
Well, I love it. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join me, dude. Look forward to having you on next week, buddy.
Cheers, Virgil. Thank you.
All right, we return. We're headed to the range. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here, 104.5 The Zone.
You know the race day excitement of steeplechase. The hats, the bow ties, the horses, and the people. The running of the 77th Iroquois Steeplechase presented by Bank of America is Saturday, May 12th at Percy Warner Park. And it's time to plan your race day experience. Make tailgating a breeze by purchasing your all-inclusive tickets to Champions Corner. Sponsored by Jack Daniel's Tennessee Fire today. Don't get burned. Drink responsibly. The 77th Iroquois Steeplechase. For tickets and info, go to 1045thezone.com. Nobody said
it was easy. Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. So at this time every Saturday morning, we make the turn and decide it's a better idea to go to the range, the Orca driving range. And this week, I'm bringing in the director of instruction at the University of Louisville Golf Club, one of the best teachers in the country, Michael Finney. Michael, how are you today, buddy?
I'm doing great, Virgil. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Well, I'm interested in your opinion because I really trust your judgment when it comes to the ability to pass out technical information in a chewable, digestible manner. But in recent times, I'd say within the last year and a half, we probably learned more about the golf swing and what really is going on than ever before. But sometimes the words, if we're going to use them properly, the actual term, seems so big and so monstrous to for the average consumer golfer that it either scares them away or it sounds like somebody's tooting their own horn about how much they know about the golf swing. Do you believe that the ability to take golfers to the next level has more to do with the student learning to understand the new proper way to do things? Or do you think the teachers have to adjust to the players' learning styles better?
That's a great question. I really think it ultimately is up to the teacher to adjust his approach. That the last thing we want to do is to have to take a student and put him through a pop quiz on some of the terms that we're using. We need to figure out how to get correct information. Doesn't have to be technical information, but correct information to the student so he can take, or he or she can take it, to whatever level that they want to go to. So I definitely think the teacher is the one that needs to do the adjusting, and then the player can hopefully receive a good, consistent message that has some good, actionable information to act upon. So, lots of times people ask me this question quite often, about, do you use these terms that I see you talking about and stuff like that. Often it's the things I don't say in a lesson that makes me a better teacher, because I think in the past we were kind of, giving out what we thought was good information, but having the new tools that we have, we've figured out what is actually more likely happening. Then we can kind of distill our instruction down to where we're not having to use these big words. We're just going down avenues that we know has some validity, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah. And if I find it's so fascinating. I love my job. I do radio and TV too, but I'm mostly golf. I'm a golf instructor guy. And
right.
I find it so fascinating that there are trends. So like right now, It appears on the driving range and where I spend most of my time that everybody has taken the Alex Noren pill and they're working on their hips rotating off their back leg and the club working behind them. And, the new terminology, which leads to this stuck is good, not stuck is bad. And it was, but like maybe 8 years ago that stuck was terrible and got to transfer your weight. Do you believe that that's more of a fad? Or do you believe that I'll try to explain it so the listeners can grasp it, that the downswing has more early rotation than extension toward a target than a shift to the left and turn? Do you feel like that's more of where we're actually headed because it's better for the golf swing and the body? Or do you think that this is just a tasty little fad?
Wow, that's a really great observation. I chuckle because when I hear people talk about these quote unquote fads and people mimicking the good players at the club, what they might be working on. And those good players might be mimicking something they saw on a Tuesday at a tour event. And so, you know, we're searching to get better. And if we're a 10 handicapper and we see the 5 handicapper working on something, we might say, hey, that might be for me. But to kind of bring it back to your question, I don't think there's a simple blanket solution. I honestly know that there is a ton of rotation in the golf swing, and there is some lateral move too. And a blending of the two is always going to be present in most high-end golf swings. You know, what George Gankus does and, you know, countless other guys do in squatting into the ground and working around, you know, to the left leg and having the club trail behind you and swing back out, I think is a good pill for some people. It's not for everybody. So I would be hesitant to put that on everybody I teach, but I don't hesitate to put it on some of the people that I teach that I feel that need a little bit more of a rotational feel. So, again, it's the art of golf instruction. You know, we're taking all this science and we're trying to be artists and we're trying to, you know, put the right things into people's golf swings. And for me to say, you know, rotation trumps lateral movement or vice versa would be, you know, would maybe be kind of putting the cart before the horse. And I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I think that it's really important for the listeners out there to understand is that there is no such thing as the golf swing.
No.
The human body has a variety of firing patterns. I've often found that the hardest thing to change from anybody is what their first go move is. When the transition, like the back end of the backswing's coming, and that what they feel is their initial firing mechanism into the golf ball, I have found that to be really difficult to change over the years. So I've just kind of tried to put their golf swing in a place with a pivot that whatever that is, it goes in the proper line toward the golf ball. Help the listener out there understand what's so important about understanding that there's, you know, no such thing as the golf swing, but some critical components to follow when it comes to improving their ball striking.
The golfing machine, you know, said there's trillions of golf swings, and that is one thing that Homer Kelly got right. I mean, there are trillions of ways to hit a golf ball, trillions. And we see it every day on TV, even those swings on the PGA Tour, you know, produce all these consistent ball flights. You know, everybody's doing it slightly differently. So there is no one golf swing, that's for sure. They're really, you know, as teachers, I think we've done a good job as an industry of this. We can't be, and we just already referenced this, we can't have a cookie cutter approach to good ball striking, because Braden Thornberry's out there dominating people, and gosh knows he's not coming out of a cookie cutter. So, you know, what are some of the things that produce great ball striking? Wow. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things, but it seems like irons are, you know, obviously designed to hit the ball off the ground. And they, I think a consistent theme is some amount of shaft lean at impact, I think is a pretty good indicator of somebody's ability. Now, obviously you've got hackers that have some shaft lean, so it's not a cure-all. But people that can take the club face and basically close it a little bit more, and then from that closing of the club face, get a little bit more shaft lean at impact, take the 7-iron and make it into a 6-iron instead of taking a 7-iron and making it into an 8-iron, I think is one of the most common things I see in great ball strikers, you know, to be able to get that penetrating flight and be able to work the ball both ways. I mean, obviously you can work the ball both ways with no shaft lean, but a little bit of shaft lean seems to be a common denominator of a lot of good ball strikers.
Yeah, I think that it also, and I would love to hear your opinion on this. I believe that the shaft lean has two problems in it, which is most people feel like the shaft is leaning forward but not pulling up, and that's a problem.
Oh, yeah.
And another thing is that I look at, you know, when you look at a little bit of shaft lean, it's actually has a lot of down hit in it, you know, with a, you know, like J.B. Holmes, my goodness, or Scott Stallings. Their shaft hits the ball on video, it looks a little forward. But with how much their core is rotating ahead of impact, if your belt buckle and your sternum were headlights, it's left of the golf ball, shining the lights left of the golf ball, that's where the real lag is how far around their chest is compared to where the ball gets hit. Even though the shaft then appears to be, you know, fairly straight up and down or lean forward. How important is it for people to understand how you do not return to set up at impact with your chest and your hips?
I mean, definitely, I agree with all of that. The thing that I keep coming back to, and I've said this for a decent amount of time, is how much different the travel of the handle of the club, the grip of the club, is from the travel of the head. I mean, I was victim of this. I thought the club just kind of traveled through space, and whatever the handle was doing, the head was doing. And you know, they're whatever 35, 40 inches apart. You know, the middle of your grip down to the club head, whatever the case may be, and they experience different trips around our body. And I think you just described one of those things. The handle's going up and in, and the head is going down and out. And I think that one little piece of information, if I could go back in time to when I was 20, would have helped my golf game a ton. And understanding that you didn't have to make the grip mimic the head and make the grip go down and out. The club was going to be going down and out, no problem, and the hands were going to be going up and in. And we have countless. I wouldn't say countless, but we've got a bunch of golf researchers, quote unquote, that have shown the difference between the grip travel and the head travel, and how much force is going towards a golfer, and then the head is delivering a blow, you know, towards a golf ball down and out. So I think that one little observation has changed my way of looking at golf swings, and definitely teaching golf swings.
As a person who I believe is on that cutting edge front where you are, what is something that you've learned about the golf swing recently, let's say in the last 6 months, that kind of got your fire going and got you excited about getting back into that lesson scenario and start helping people take their game to the next level? What's that one thing that got you going this year?
Wow. I'm constantly learning. I'm constantly studying. I'm constantly trying to learn from my friends and acquaintances that are much smarter than I am. And I mean, just having short conversations with some of these guys, like a Sasha McKenzie, like a Mike Duffy, makes me think all the time. And something small like Sasha and I were talking about this maybe 30 days ago. Mike, you know, what makes somebody swing a 5-iron 90 miles an hour, and then that same person swings his driver at 115, and then you have another student, similar type golfer, swings his 5-iron 90 miles an hour, and then swings his driver 102. And you know what makes that happen? And I mean, I know that might not have a lot of bearing on my next lesson that I give this weekend. But yeah, it's why can some people generate the speed that they do with the longer club, and then the next person can't? So I mean, that's not a very good example of what you've asked me to give. But you know, questions like that, you know, make you really think about how people produce the speed that they produce, and it just makes you want to learn how the body moves the golf club even more. That's a terrible example. I'm trying to think of something that might
You made a good point, though. You actually have an interesting point. You're going on to something that's very intriguing to me. As a former long driver, and now I'm getting old and my body's falling apart, you know, I have a bunch of kids on the golf team that I coach that hit 7-iron. You know, they're swinging their 7-iron like 94 miles per hour.
Right.
And I'm swinging it like 89, 91-ish. And they're hitting it like 15 yards longer than me. And then we get to the driver and their club head speed's 112-ish and mine's 119-ish. And I don't have the answer to that question. I'm wondering, is it just a body's natural reaction to the club head traveling in the circle? Or do you feel like it's just how the body uses the earth to launch on the driver versus going to the ground more with the 7-iron? I don't know.
Yeah. again, and this is on the initial part of all this stuff, but, you know, a guy like Sasha doesn't know the answer. So that's why he's going to be looking into stuff like this. And, I think it has a lot to do. And actually, I want to actually make a short video about this pretty soon. And I do these videos to try to, it's for me to kind of work through what I am thinking, you know, currently about the golf swing. I think there's a lot to do with the club and the left arm, or both arms for that matter, how far or close they are from the body, and how we handle, you know, the club and the center of mass of the club and its distance from our body is one thing. Like the figure skater example, you know, you bring everything in, you can turn faster, you move everything out, you turn slower. But separately from that is how our hands can move the club as a unit. So, I mean, there's a lot of interactions between the arms and club and the body, and then separately the club and the hands. So I think there's some of that mystery is wrapped up in that, and how we handle a stick that has the center of mass a little bit further away, from us than we probably would, you know, a regular broom handle. You know, the club head has most of the weight at the end, and how we handle that weight. And some people can handle it better than others and create more speed. The mechanisms of why they create more speed, we don't know. And that's something that, we're going to take a look at. It may not be earth shattering if we ever come up with some of these mechanisms, but it might help somebody down the road understand how maybe we take a guy who swings his driver 105 and maybe, you know, pump him up a little bit higher if we understand what makes people swing the five at 90 and swing the five at 115 versus a tighter window there. So anyway, it's really interesting to look at.
I'll say that was intriguing. I actually think that you're onto something there. Not that it's just you that's on, but I was like, I hadn't really thought of that, about the center mass of the club, how far it is from the hands making a difference, but that's almost like what I feel. And that's interesting. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule. How can my listeners get in touch with your expertise and come see you at the University of Louisville Golf Club?
Yeah, the club has a nice website, the University of Louisville Golf Club. It's ulgc.com. And then I think on Twitter, it's M Finney Golf is my Twitter handle. And somebody could, you know, send me a note through Twitter. And if they're in the region and they wanted to drive into Louisville and take a lesson or just talk about the golf swing, I'm always at the club 6 days a week, take Mondays off, and they can send me a note and we can get together.
Michael, that was awesome stuff. Thank you for coming on, and I look forward to seeing you soon, okay?
Appreciate it, Virgil. Thanks for having me on.
All right, we return. We're going to finish strong, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone.
The $1,000 payoff, giving you four chances a day to win $1,000. Tune in at 8 a.m., 11 a.m., 2 p.m., and 5 p.m. every weekday. The Sports Station, 104.5 The Zone.
It's time to finish strong, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring, as it is absolutely pouring here in Nashville. Unbelievable. Again. We had three Januaries. I just hope we don't have three Julys. Anyway, I find it fascinating to talk about technology and learning golf. Golf is such a fascinating game because it mirrors life in so many ways, one in which is that you can try as hard as you can to elevate your game and see incremental, almost non-noticeable day-to-day improvement and get, lose interest because you don't see that your diet's working or your exercise routine's working, and you just abort the mission, so to speak. And golf is very similar to that, in which people work on their technique and they get it right where they want it to be, and then they try to go play with it and they don't perform well, and they blame their golf swing, or they all of a sudden they think that they're not in the right place or they're not doing the right things. And either they'll quit the game or they'll lose the passion to play. And therein lies this weird dilemma of how much goes into the golf swing and how much goes into the mental preparation to play golf if you're trying to compete at anything, whether you're just playing with your buddies or, you know, trying to win your high school tournament, state championship, college tournament, professional tour event. somewhere in there lies this place where you work on the golf swing enough to be proficient to create a circle. Circle being whatever some people call the swing plane, although there is no such thing as a swing plane. It's the circle that you see. As soon as it's proficient enough, it almost shifts out of physical and into a mental space that frees you up. And I've always likened it to the movie The Matrix, in which once you've hit a shot, you know how to hit the shot. You just have to be able to call on it again. And Lanny Basham, one of the best sports psychologists out there, is on record saying that the calling your golf shot is not the most important or the most powerful thing. It's recalling your golf shot. And we've all hit great golf shots. If you've played the game and just enjoyed one hole, you've hit great golf shots. But I'm the coach of the Ensworth Golf School, and our golf team is full of brilliant young kids with a ton of talent. And sometimes I see this talent, it's almost like an expectation burden that they're lugging around, and they fall out of what they want to do, whether it be out of expectations of others or unrealistic expectations of watching Jordan Spieth or Rory McIlroy, or not so much now, but maybe in the day, Tiger Woods. But at the end of the day, somewhere in between all of this physical work and physical talent, you have to put yourself in a position where you can trust it and know how your pre-shot routine and your mental processes prior to the shot play as much or more of a role in hitting the shot you want than just having this awesome golf swing, which has awesome pivots and wrist angles and powerful ground forces and excellent releases. All of those things are very important. I don't discount that. I teach that all the time. But the piece that has me the most intrigued is the brain and how it allows people to perform magically when they're, you know, in the arena. And it always comes from that place, and it's from way less effort than we think. It's learning how to control those things, which is so powerful. And as for many of you out there may not know, that the Ensworth Golf Center is open to the public. It's not a closed facility for the school or its athletes. It is open to the public to learn. We can measure every single thing in golf except a bunker shot. Gears Golf allows us to analyze the body and the golf clubs and its rotations and torques more than anything ever has. TrackMan, we've already known what TrackMan can and cannot do forever. Well, for the last 10 years, it's the foremost authority in ball flight. Sam Putt Lab, amazing. Focus Band is the game breaker. It's the total package when it comes to helping people break through. So please, we have a great staff of teachers, Barney Allery, Pat Seller, Stephen Hodge, myself, out there to help you. So if you want to take your game to the next level, whether it be through your short game, your full swing, or your mental understanding, come check us out. It's an amazing place. Feel free to contact me at Virgil Torspin to get involved. For my producer, Jimmy Hopper, Michael Finney, Jim Nugent, and Rich Hunt, thank you very much for making us part of your day. Have a great one.